Our topic for tonight is Sanctify Yahweh of Hosts Himself, taken from Isaiah chapter 8. It gives me great pleasure to invite our brother Brian Luke to lead us in that consideration of Isaiah 8.
Dear Brother Peter and dear class members, our last class was actually held, of course, in the Christie's Downs Hall, wasn't it? In which we had the opportunity of going into that area to prosper the work that our brethren and sisters in that area have undertaken. And you'll remember that the theme of that class was taken from verse 6, "For as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloah that go softly." There was an opportunity before them all the time which they had refused, and because of that, then the great waters of the king of Assyria is symbolically described in verse 7 as the waters of the river strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. So verse 7 makes it very clear that the invasion, the great invasion that is in mind in chapter 8, is the Assyrian invasion. Of course, wherever you have Assyria, you can always take it on further to the latter day Assyrian, to the Russo-Assyrian power, as Brother Thomas liked to refer to it. And so also in this case as well, you can take this on to that time yet to come. That is the ultimate application. But the great invasion that was clearly in the prophet's mind is made clear, isn't it, from verse 7. It says in verse 8 that he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go over, he shall reach even to the neck. In other words, some part of the land would be left. If the water rises to the neck, then at least the head is still above the water. And in this case, of course, that neck was holding up the city of Jerusalem, that when all of Judah may have lain at the feet of the king of Assyria, that nevertheless was saved. As in chapter 1 and verse 8, the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. And the waters lapping around that neck, in another figure, was the soldiers of the Assyrians encamped around that city and cutting off every opportunity to escape therefrom, except and only if they should look unto Yahweh their God. For where else could they look in a circumstance like that? And it was in the vortex of that great crisis that came upon them that that people began to think more and more of their God and to actually implicate very beautifully the words of the rest of this chapter that we are here to look at tonight. Chapter 8 is a very beautiful chapter. Firstly, it was seen in their king who found strength in the communication through Isaiah unto Yahweh. And that then came back to the people as a whole. And so that city, the remnant that was left, that head of the nation, against which the waters of Assyria were lapping, that was saved when the rest of the nation went. It says in verse 8, emphasizing the all-encompassing nature of that invasion, it says, "The stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel." And that's true, it did. The Assyrian invasion was very significant. It did not just involve the city of Jerusalem. In a later chapter, in chapter 10, there's given a whole list of the cities that the Assyrian came through. Very quickly, in chapter 10, verse 28. Verse 28 to 32, you'll notice there's a list of cities. He has come to Ahath. He has passed to Migron. At Michmash he hath laid up his carriages. Geba is there in verse 29, and Ramah and Gibeah, old names, aren't they? Old names, very much related to the whole history of Israel. But Assyria is coming down through all of that area, and she did. She really did overflow Judah, but she never took the city of Jerusalem. And that night, of course, that famous night, in the midst of the king's great sickness, in the midst of all of those prevailing circumstances, the angel of Yahweh arose and struck dead 185,000 Assyrians and the head of the nation Jerusalem was saved. So it's interesting in verse 8 that it referred to the land as Emmanuel. It shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. And I'm sure that's putting for the very beautiful thought that whilst this barbarian power, it should be given a lease against the people of God for a season, yet nevertheless that land was still stamped with the existence, the presence of God upon that land. Like no other in all the world, Emmanuel, God with us. You know, there's a pertinent phrase that we ought to bear in mind even in the very hour in which we are living. In Leviticus chapter 25, there's a very famous passage in respect to the land of Israel. The 25th chapter and verse 23. The land shall not be sold forever. This is a command given to Israelites, let alone to Gentiles, who never had any entitlement to it by any slight imagination. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, for ye are strangers and sojourners with me. Look at that for a passage. How remarkably relevant that is today, when in the capital of Catholic Spain, the leader of Tarshish and the Prince of Roche, as it were, meet together as co-chairmen. The great powers of the world, co-chairman, to tell Israel whose land that is. What an amazing thing we are seeing before our eyes. The land is mine ought to be in the opening reading of that conference. And nothing that they determine will ever change God's determination about that. The land is mine, and God will give that to whom it will rightly be given. What an amazing thing that in Catholic Spain, that has done nothing more than hate and persecute the Jews for over 1,000 years, that in Spain, in the capital of Spain, they should be there meeting. Tarshish should know better. And the representative of Roche there as co-chairman, debating with the Palestinians that got their name from Philistines as to what that land, where that land ought to go. What an incredibly interesting thing. We truly are living, aren't we, in remarkable times. Well, you see, it's Emmanuel's land. It's a land where God has dwelt. No other land has ever had the Shekinah glory, the dwelling glory, that word Shekinah means. And so just as Assyria would come down over that land and fill it so that it might think the land was its own, the record of Isaiah so beautifully says that it's Emmanuel's land. You know, old Brother Lindsay Cahoon used to love that title. Do you remember that? I don't know if some of you were ever instructed with Lindsay Cahoon, but when he referred to Israel, he always had to call it Emmanuel's land. Just one of his little idiosyncrasy. But that's where he gets it from, you see. It's apparently a term too that Henry Sully liked. But that was just something I remember in respect to Brother Lindsay, that he used to often refer to that land as Emmanuel's land. So Assyria would come, but the land would belong to the presence of God as no other land would. Now in verses 9 to 10, there is a call to the nations. The nations are invited to associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces. And give ear, all ye of far countries. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. For Emmanuel. And there's your connection back to verse 8 again. So whilst Assyria again might seem to come over that land and dominate it, yet it's not going to ultimately succeed. Never mind what confederacy of people is put together. Look at the wonderful relevance of that in the light of the very days we're living today. Why won't that come to anything? Because God is with us, said Isaiah. So in these verses, the nations are invited to associate themselves together. There is a question about the word people. In the AV rendition, in verse 9, it has the word people in the singular. But the Revised Version and a Revised Standard Version rightly correct that to the plural, to peoples. In other words, it's the same then as the sense of the next phrase, give ear all ye of far countries. So it's not speaking to the nation of Israel as we may have first thought, and at one time I felt that phrase was referring to Judah. It's referring rather to the foreign powers beyond Judah. The term associate yourselves actually has more than one possible translation. It's what is described as a double meaning word. It can mean to work evil, or it can mean to behave like a flock of sheep. Now I think it's the second sense of association, of coming together. And I think that because of the flow of the thought, you take verse 9 as a whole. Associate yourselves. Give ear. Having heard that, gird yourselves. Get ready. Gird yourselves again. Take counsel together, and it shall come to. See the sense of that? There's a kind of build up of idea through verse 9. Therefore, I'm in favour of that second rendition. The flow of thought seems to fit in very well with that. Now, the other thing that we notice in that verse is that one phrase is repeated three times, isn't it? It's what we might call a satirical refrain. Associate yourselves, O ye peoples, ye shall be broken in pieces. Well, I mean, people don't come together to associate themselves together, do they? They're going to be broken in pieces. And that refrain is satirically repeated through that verse 9. They can do what they like. They can make all kinds of plans. They can listen to each other and plot and determine. They can gird themselves in preparations for battle, but the whole lot will come to naught. It shall not stand, are the two expressions in verse 10 that speak of its finality. Now, who was associating themselves? Who was taking counsel together? We've already had indication, haven't we, in chapter 7, of who was doing that. But just in case some of our class members tonight were not at the earlier classes, remember chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. Came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. And it was told the house of David, saying, Syria is confederate with Ephraim. The Gentile Syrians had made an alliance with the northern kingdom of Ephraim. And verse 5 and 6. Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, let us go up against Judah. Well, there we have some of the words, don't we? Take counsel together, chapter 8, verse 10 says. And so the prophet is satirically encouraging the Syrians and the northern kingdom to do what you like, says Isaiah. Come together and talk it all through. Make your plans and prepare yourself for the battle. And be broken in pieces, broken in pieces, broken in pieces. Whatever you plan, it will come to naught. Speak the word, verse 10. It says in verse 10, the third line there, speak the word. Speaking a speak, as it literally means. But never mind what they determined, what command was given. There's a lovely play upon that phrase in the latter part of the chapter. Nevertheless, it would not stand. Now, why wouldn't it stand? Because despite all of those counsels and plans and ideas, God is with us. And that word God is the word El. It's the word at the end of the word Emmanuel in verse 8. And the word El means strength. So never mind how many countries you put together in your string of confederates, yet God's strength is with us. Never mind how many soldiers you put together, strength is with us. Isn't that beautiful? Now, we mentioned last time very briefly that Psalm 46 fitted in with that section very well indeed. Did anybody take up the idea of making a little list of comparisons? Well, I've just got a few here. I'm sure that you could increase this if you like. But perhaps if somebody reads the little portions from the Psalms and someone else the portions from Isaiah 8, we'll see how beautifully all of these things correlate together. Now, Psalm 46 and verse 1. Sim, would you like to read that? And Daniel, would you like to read Isaiah 8 verse 22 after Sim? How's that? Sim, Psalm 46 verse 1.
God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble.
Yes, so Psalm 46 verse 1 is speaking of a time of crisis. A lot of pressure there, isn't it? In time of trouble, very present help, in time of trouble, a refuge and strength, Ael is with us, okay? Isaiah 8 verse 22 then, please, Dan. Right, so there obviously is a kindred time, all right? Now verse 2, thanks, Sim.
Therefore, will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea?
And Isaiah 8, verse 13, please, Dan, speaks of fear. Verse 12 and 13. The last part of 12 and 13.
Confederacy, neither fear ye, lest fear nor be afraid. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your afraid.
Right. In verse 3 of Psalm 46, what do we have, Sim?
Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, Selah.
And then Isaiah 8, verse 8.
And he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go over. He shall rebuild the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel.
So there is, again, a comparative situation. The same symbols are used, in which the troubles are seen as the great outbreaking of waters upon the people of God. Right. Now, verse 4 of Psalm 46 speaks of an alternative stream. Thanks, Sim.
There is a river, the strength whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High.
There is a little stream which is related to the city of God, to Jerusalem. And there was only one such, wasn't there? And that was that little stream that came from the spring of Gihon, whose waters were taken back into the city, and the people therefore had the water of life in a time of great and dangerous siege without. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God. And so it's set in defiance of verse 3. Vast waters washing up against them, against their walls. But there was a stream, a little stream that gave them great heart and encouragement in the midst of all of their troubles. Shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is with us, the tabernacles of the Most High. Very beautiful. All right, verse 6, of course, of Isaiah 8. Dan.
For as much as his people refuse the waters of Shiloh, they go softly and rejoice in Rezin and Rebeliah's son.
There's the little stream, isn't it? All right, verse 5, thanks, Sim.
God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early.
Right, Isaiah 8, verse 10, the last phrase, Dan.
And it shall not stand.
Yeah, God is in the midst of us, of her, says the psalm. God is with us. And again in verse 18, please, Dan, the last part.
Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion.
Which dwelleth in Mount Zion. God is in the midst of her.
so she shall not be moved. Right? Verse 6 of the Psalm.
The heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted.
There is an international confederacy involved in the sense of verse 6, isn't it? It's like Psalm 2. The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against his anointed. That's exactly what we've got, isn't it? In Isaiah 8 and verse 9. Associate yourselves, O ye people, and it shall be broken in pieces. Sorry, Dan, I took it. Alright, so there's verse 9. Verse 7 of the Psalm, please, Dan. Psalm 46.
Yahweh of armies is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah.
Right. And in the Isaiah 8, verse 10. Thanks, Dan.
Take counsel together, and you shall come and all. Speak the word, and you shall not see, for God is with us.
Yes. Yahweh of hosts is with us. For Ael is with us, or again, verse 18, Yahweh of hosts who dwelleth in Mount Zion. Exactly the same thought. There can be no question about Psalm 46's time period. Finally, verse 11, there we have the expression, Sim, verse 11.
Yahweh of armies is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah.
The God of Jacob is our refuge. So in verse 13 of Isaiah 8,
sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread.
In other words, he's our refuge. We should have the answer tonight, isn't it? Yahweh is our refuge, but I don't think we have. So there's a very wonderful comparison between the Psalm and Isaiah chapter 8, and leaves us in no question that that Psalm was coined in the time, was struck at the time of the invasion of the power of Assyria. We might comment in respect to today's situation, my dear brothers and sisters, that if only Israel would put their trust in Yahweh, then they would keep that land. But you know, the truth is that Shemaiah and those who have followed him have gone to that land with all kinds of human reasonings. It's not because they're going to reason from the Bible. It's because of human reasonings. They have not really got God with them in that sense. The outcome, therefore, of that conference, we shall have to wait and see. We really couldn't be dogmatic about what is likely to happen. One thing we do certainly not expect is that the land will be given over to the Arabs. We don't believe that because of the turns of Ezekiel 38. When the northern invader comes down through that land, it is upon the mountains that God takes forth his sword and destroys that invading army. If it's upon the mountains, then one would indeed expect that the Jewish people are upon that mountain, because that's what they've come to take. And therefore, I don't believe that Israel will evacuate the West Bank, as the world calls it, or Judea and Samaria, as the Bible calls it. What a poignant thing it is in the sense of the issues that we have today. You know, there's another very significant thing that's happened too in a closer way in recent days. We've had our determination from the appeals tribunal in respect to our Hebron camp. And unfortunately, brethren and sisters, the report is not at all favourable to our cause. The dormitory application, and there were other things as well, has been knocked back by the tribunal, and that is a cause of very great concern to us all. Just where we go from there, we do not know. We're seeking some advice on that matter, but it is a matter, isn't it, of very grave concern, because we have felt time and again that God has opened for us a situation which might otherwise be very difficult to obtain. And for the sake of our young people, we are desperately in need of some place for them to be able to find a camp of the numbers which they have. And also, of course, some of our ecclesial camps are in that kind of number as well. So what we have to do in circumstances like that is is take the prophet's words to heart. We have had all kinds of confederations against us. We have had a confederacy of the neighbours eventually formed. We've had a confederacy of the neighbours with the council. They virtually got into place in the council, the men that they wanted, through a lot of hard work. And now we virtually have the tribunal in confederacy with them as well. And in those circumstances, it's not very easy, is it, to feel daunted by the prospects. It's a test of our faith, a very great test of our faith, and of our need to realise that we must put our hand in our God's. That whatever confederacy there may be, God will give us what we should have. And if it is to be that we shall find a place, then I'm sure that we shall find it. But certainly, my dear brothers and sisters, we have had to rely upon him, and we're going to have to do that again in the future. So, one on the international scene and another application that's very close to hand. Now, I suppose that comes particularly close to this ecclesia, because without a shadow of a doubt, the Brighton Ecclesia has been a very great supporter of the work at Hebron. A very great supporter. More so, really, person for person, than any other meeting, for which we can be thankful. It hasn't hurt any of us, but it's very much therefore related to our ecclesia. And we pray that God will hear our petitions at this time and find for us a place in which we can carry out those good exercises for which that project was originally conceived. Now, in verses 11 to 15, we have Yahweh's advice of faith. There's the confederacy doomed to failure. In verses 11 to 15, we have the advice of faith. For God is with us, is the last phrase. And then it says, for Yahweh spake thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, God indeed was with them, wasn't he? He was with them in the prophet Isaiah. And in the words that he will then say to Isaiah, we can see again that God is with them. He is not in the company of the Assyrians. He is not in the temples of the Assyrians. He is in Jerusalem. He is with the people of Judah. He is in the spirit of the prophet. Yahweh spake thus to me with a strong hand. You don't speak with a hand, do you? So the Revised Standard Version says, Yahweh spoke with his strong hand upon me. That's more to the sense of it, isn't it? There was a consolidating hand upon the prophet. Like a father might take his son and place his hand upon his shoulder and give him support in the cause which he wishes to direct him to. So Isaiah felt that paternal feeling come upon him. He spoke to him with a strong hand upon his shoulder. And what he said to Isaiah was this, that he should not walk in the way of this people. There was a political current that was running through the people of Judah. And Yahweh said to the prophet, I wish you not to stand in that council. I wish you to think differently. Don't walk in the way of this people. For what were they saying? The whole place was buzzing with the talk of alliance and confederacy. Say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. So obviously the talk of the town, the political topic of the times was, how are we going to make a confederacy? Are we going to do it with these, or are we going to do it with those? You know, there was a possibility, perhaps, that if Assyria looked like she might be a problem, perhaps then what we ought to be doing is making alliance with Israel and with Syria. There's three of us then. What about Edom and Moab? There were all kinds of possibilities. You know, in later times, Judah did exactly the same thing. If you turn quickly to Jeremiah chapter 27. In later times, when the king of Babylon would come upon them, we read in Jeremiah chapter 27 and verse 1, in the beginning of the reign of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, came this word unto Jeremiah from Yahweh, saying, Thus saith Yahweh to me, Make thee bonds and yokes, and put them upon thy neck, and send them to the king of Edom, to the king of Moab, to the king of the Ammonites, and to the king of Tyre, and to the king of Sidon. However you're going to do that. Did the prophet take a trip off to all of those different places? No. By the hand of the messengers which come to Jerusalem unto Zedekiah, king of Judah. What does that mean? It means that those different foreign powers had sent their ambassadors to Jerusalem to make a confederacy with Zedekiah. Why? Because they knew that the tokens of Babylon's advance and invasion of their land were very clear. And so they came together, these smaller nations, to see if there was a chance that they might, by alliance, defend themselves together against the king of Babylon. Very interesting, isn't it? The same story all over again. And you remember how that the yokes were taken back to those kings, and one of the false prophets, he endeavoured in the chapter 28, Hananiah was his name, he endeavoured to break that yoke. And he said, within 2 full years will I bring again this place, into this place, all the vessels of Yahweh's house that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took away from this place and carried them to Babylon. Chapter 28 and verse 3. And he died within 6 months of that year. You know, it was a very difficult thing, though, for Jeremiah to stand up against the thought of the city. It's like Christadelphians in time of the war. Here's a boy, 18, 19, 20 years of age, still going about his duties, his apprenticeship or his course or whatever, and next door there's a family who's got their son or their 2 sons over there fighting in the war, supposedly to strengthen their country against possible invasion. Tremendous pressure in that. And what Isaiah was told by God was that he was not to walk in the way of this people. The people may well have thought, but aren't you concerned, Isaiah? We've got to do something. That's how they felt about Jeremiah. When Jeremiah said to them, look, the salvation of this city is to give yourself over to the king of Babylon. In the chapter before, chapter 27, they threatened him with treason for that very reason. It came to pass, verse 8 of chapter 26, when Jeremiah had made an end of speaking all that Yahweh had commanded him to speak unto all the people, that the priests and the prophets and all the people took him and saying, thou shalt surely die. Why hast thou prophesied in the name of Yahweh, saying, this house shall be like Shiloh, and this city shall be desolate without an inhabitant? May they not have felt the same in the days of Isaiah? Was he not in equally a difficult situation? Wouldn't it have been far easier to walk in the way of this people? He was in a dangerous situation, for he was saying, the land will indeed be invaded. What they were doing was talking about building human defences against that. And it may well have seemed that Isaiah was very unpatriotic, very unconcerned, as people may think when we go off to work in the time of world war and their sons are out on the field of battle. A very difficult time indeed. Yahweh spake thus to me with a strong hand, with an encouraging and strengthening hand upon him, that he should not walk in the way of this people whose whole political concern was about confederacy. Now in the 30th chapter it makes it clear that there was even yet a further alternative. What other alternative would there be if we were to think of confederacy in Judah? What was the other possibility? Egypt, that's right. And so in Isaiah chapter 30, as we might expect, that possibility is discussed. Woe to the rebellious children, saith Yahweh, that take counsel, but not of me. See, take counsel, same expression, chapter 8. And that cover with the covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin, that walk to go down into Egypt, and have not asked at my mouth, to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh, and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust and the shadow of Egypt your confusion. For his princes were at Zoan, and his ambassadors came to Harnes. They were all ashamed of a people that could not profit them, nor be an help for profit. You see, the princes of Egypt in the time of the Syrian invasion, they came up to Jerusalem to see what kind of a deal could be made. And the people were very interested in this. Verse 7, for the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore have I cried concerning this. Their strength is to sit still and put their trust in God. So that was another possibility that would in fact be sought by the people in due time. What does it mean then when it says, neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid? Do you remember that Yahweh was spoken of as the fear of Isaac? In Genesis 31, verse 42, God was spoken of as the fear of Isaac. In other words, it was that God who Isaac reverenced. So in a sense, I suppose, here the fear that they were fearing was the Assyrian. But behind the Assyrian, of course, was the gods of Assyria. And so God is saying, fear not Assyria, nor the gods of Assyria. Or as Yahweh was the fear of Isaac, and so the gods of the Assyrians may well be the fear of the Assyrians. Now, the record, of course, tells us some very graphic things highly related to that. The historical record in 2 Chronicles 28. How relevant were the prophet's words. Verse 16, at that time did King Ahaz send unto the kings of Assyria to help him. Verse 20, Tilgath-Pilneser, king of Assyria, came unto him and distressed him, but strengthened him not. Ail is with us. Strengthened his not. End of verse 21. But he helped him not. And in the time of his distress did he trespass yet more against Yahweh. This is that king Ahaz, for he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus, which smote him. And he said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, therefore will I sacrifice to them, that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. Fear not their fear, nor their dread. Now in the 2 of Kings record, there's even more graphic illustration of the relevance of the prophet's words to this time. 2 of Kings, verse 7. We've commented on this before, the pathetic words of Ahaz. Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, verse 7 of 2 of Kings 16, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. Sickening to read, isn't it? I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasures of the king's house and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria. Verse 10, King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus, and King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest, who was one of the two people, you remember, who witnessed the writing of the name Maher Shalal Hashbaz. He sent to him the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. And so Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made it against King Ahaz came from Damascus. And when the king was come from Damascus back to Jerusalem, the king Ahaz saw the altar, and the king approached the altar and offered thereon. How relevant indeed were the prophet's words to the people, where he pleaded with them, say not a confederacy, neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. And yet, obviously, the attitude of the king was right through the population as a whole. What was the alternative, my dear brothers and sisters? Back to Isaiah chapter 8, verse 13. Here was the alternative. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, taken from verse 12, and let him be your dread, taken also from verse 12. For the word fear is the same in both occasions, and the word afraid and dread are related. So there's a play there upon the Hebrew. So instead of talking about human confederacies, they had to put their trust in Yahweh. What is to sanctify Yahweh of hosts? It's a very relevant statement, isn't it? It is in their thinking to revere him, to set him apart in their thinking, to make his name holy, to hallow his name. That is to sanctify Yahweh of hosts. Bring him into your life. Stop running around talking about confederacy, what we will do politically here, who we might link up with there. But sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself. Make your linkage unto your God. Draw near unto him at this time, rather than be concerned about all the human politics that beset the kingdom of Judah at that time. Now, it must have been a very difficult thing in some respects. When he brought the altar back, there must have been a great change in the temple scene. If we can imagine it before and after, we have the temple here. He didn't change that. But after the temple, there was the altar. And there was the laver here, of course. And that was the altar of burnt offering. And it was, of course, a brazen altar of burnt offering, often referred to as the brazen altar. Okay? Well, what he did is put that to the north. So up here we have the brazen altar of burnt offering. That's the original that Moses gave him. But it's been taken out of its privileged position and, as it were, put in the corner. It's not being used. In its place there was a great altar. I suppose the laver might still have been there. In its place there was another altar, a great altar. We'll call it the Great Altar of Damascus. And the sickening thing was, the king came there and he made his offerings. And furthermore, he said to Urijah, he said, on that altar will you make the daily offering, in the morning and in the evening. And the other great offerings, the burnt offerings of the nation, were to be made at that place. Where would you take your animal if you went up to that temple? Where would you go? You know, he didn't throw the thing out entirely, did he? It's very interesting to go back to that record in Kings. There's just one little phrase that we didn't mention. It's such a lonely phrase. It's just like the lonely altar there in the corner. The instruction given to Urijah in 2 Kings 16 verse 15 was this. King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, saying, upon the great altar burn the morning burnt offering and the evening burnt offering. They're the two most important in all of the institution of Moses. And the king's burnt sacrifice, and his meat offering, with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, and their meat offering and their drink offerings, and sprinkle upon it all the blood of the burnt offering, and all the blood of the sacrifice, and the brazen altar shall be for me to inquire by. Isn't that interesting? Despite having given this foreign altar private place
He nevertheless knew that when it came to find him, a voice to the living God, it would not come by apostasy, but it would come by means of the true altar. Isn't that interesting? He left that, never kicked it right out of the place. He left it there and left it in the corner. Because if he really wanted to find God, he knew he had to go to that altar. You know, there's something absolutely grotesque about Ahaz, isn't it? Underneath all of his provocation, he did know what was wrong. Underneath the lot of it, he nevertheless knew what was right. Otherwise, why didn't he throw that away? If I'm in desperate need, I'll have to be able to go to that altar. So pop it in the corner and just leave it there. But if you were going up to that temple, where would you go? You know, I'm sure there must have been many like Isaiah that could never ever take their animal to that false altar. They would have to take it to the altar of burnt offering that came by Moses. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself, they would have said, as they came in with their offering. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself, and let him be your fear and let him be your dread. Never mind what the king says. My offering will go in that place. Because it then says, he shall be for a sanctuary. Well, you know, all of this was called a sanctuary, wasn't it? This was the sanctuary, the house, the whole system was the sanctuary, the holy place, the place where God was. Now it's saying, Yahweh shall be for a sanctuary. Because you see, when this altar comes and dominates, this system really is finished, isn't it? The system is gone. How then will a true people find offering with God? Where will they meet him? Where will they come before him? Sanctify Yahweh, he shall be for a sanctuary. Isn't that pertinent? He shall be for a sanctuary. And the very thing, therefore, was saying that there are two houses. There is that which is still here as a remnant of what Moses gave us, but which has become corrupted. And there is another that is the true, and that is Yahweh himself. But you couldn't worship him according to the institution of Moses because it would be fouled by what the king had done. So there was an alternative system, and the alternative system was justification by faith of Yahweh. It was another institution that was being founded in that place. Another house, another approach was being determined. Now, is that the sense of it? Look at the rest of verse 14. But for a stone of stumbling and for rock of offence to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and for a snare, a trap in other words, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Now the fact that it should speak about a stone and a rock gives us the sense that it's speaking about a building, the building of a house, another house. So Yahweh shall be a stone of stumbling and a rock of offence. And yet he's going to be a sanctuary. Yahweh is going to be a sanctuary, a new house. But if you look at him another way and you can't understand his ways, if you don't think like him, if you walk in the way of this people, then he's going to be, rather than a stone upon which a whole house would be built, you'll find that he's a stumbling block. Now, it's in the later chapters of Isaiah that that is developed. In Isaiah chapter 28. You see, if we were in Israel, we would feel the impact of those words very much more quickly, because there was already a sanctuary there. What therefore is the prophet speaking about Yahweh being a sanctuary? There was already a sanctuary there. He must be speaking of something different. Well, he was. And so in Isaiah chapter 28, he develops that theme more openly. And so we read in verse 16, therefore thus saith the Lord Yahweh, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone. There's chapter 8 verse 14. A tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. Now this isn't a different stone to that in chapter 8. Obviously not.
But what was there spoken of as a stone of offence, stone of stumbling and rock of offence, is here being spoken of as the first, the foundation stone of a new house. Must be a new house. Because when Isaiah said the words of chapter 28, there was the temple just the same size as it was the day before. What therefore is he speaking here of laying in Zion a foundation, a stone? A foundation stone. Must mean, mustn't it, another house of worship. And of course it's in the 66th chapter where that is developed further, isn't it? Isaiah chapter 66. Let him be a sanctuary. Well, in Isaiah 66, verse 1, thus saith the Lord, the heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto me? And where is the place of my rest? Can you put me into a contained building that man has built? Can you so contain me, who made heaven and earth? For all those things hath mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith Yahweh, they're mine, I made them. But to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word. Now these words are highly related to what we have back there in chapter 8. Can you see the sense of verse 1 and 2? What they're saying is, you cannot build a building to contain me, but I have a building, and it's your hearts. The heart that trembles at my word, that is suppliant to what I say, that heart is my building. I dwell there. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts. That is the building in which he will dwell. And clearly again, there is implication that that house of bricks and stones is going to come down. And Yahweh is going to establish another house. You know, that's a beautiful theme of Isaiah, isn't it? Now, it's in 1 Peter chapter 2, the famous passage. No doubt very much more loved by our young people after the youth conference, where these things are brought together. Verse 6, wherefore also it is contained in the scripture, behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect and precious, and he that believeth on him shall not be confounded. That's Isaiah 28 and verse 16. But look at verse 8. A stone of stumbling and a rock of offence, even to them which stumble at the word. That phraseology is from Isaiah 8 and verse 14. You see, so he could be either one or the other. And that's what Isaiah 8 said. He can be either one or the other. He shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and a rock of offence, depending on how they accept or reject the word. If they take the word to heart, then they will rise with the foundation stone into the new building. But if they don't take it to heart, they will fall on that stone. They will stumble and they will be taken in the snare. Interesting. So Yahweh's word was going to be either mercy to those who lifted with the word, or it was going to be calamity to those who rejected that. You notice? Yes?
Well, in there in Peter, chapter 3 and verse 14, quotes Isaiah 8 and verse 12.
That's right. I was going to deal with that in a little minute. Do you want to?
No.
Can I just finish where we are in 1 Peter 2? Just a second. Says at the end of verse 8, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offence, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient. And the word was the issue in Isaiah 66, wasn't it, too? Whereunto it says, also they were appointed. Now, to hear an interesting little point. The word lay in verse 6, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, is the same word, I appoint in Zion. And that stone, of course, is the Lord Jesus Christ, the foundation stone of the living temple of God. Whereunto also they were appointed. They were appointed to stumble and fall because of the word. Where is that? It's in Isaiah chapter 8, isn't it? If you go back to Isaiah chapter 8, you'll see that that is the very expression there. There's the appointment. Some will see it as a sanctuary. Others will see it for a rock of offence and a source of stumbling. And verse 15 then says, and many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken, as was appointed, says Peter. That's interesting, isn't it? So he's really picked up the rest of Isaiah chapter 8, and he said, as they were appointed. That's a very interesting observation. Now, as Brother Max says, there is a second quotation in this chapter into Peter. And the quotation is in verses 12 and 13. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself. And that's picked up in the third chapter. Isn't it interesting that in Peter there are two passages from Isaiah chapter 8? If you turn to Peter again. In the first of Peter chapter 3, we have in verse 14, but and if ye suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are ye. Be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Why is it that there was a relevance of that passage? Well, because in the first of Peter, you're in the times of Nero, approximately AD 65 to 68. They were terrible days in which the Christians were being persecuted relentlessly by a very powerful and barbarian foe. And with that pressure upon them, there was a necessity not to walk in the way of this people. They had the pressure put upon them to recant, and if they did not, they might end up as being one of the incendiaries, or rather one of the lights in the gardens of the parties which the emperor had. The Christians were dipped in oil and hung up on poles, and they would light that body. And from the light of that ignited body, they would have their revelry. Would you recant under that sort of pressure? Tremendous pressure. And Peter, as he thought of that, he went back into these circumstances in which Isaiah found himself. So we too have to be careful, don't we, lest we walk in the ways of this people. Now, it's a little harder, isn't it, to speak the truth today, because people more and more have so little of the knowledge of God, or even the very word of God or of Christ or of the Bible in their minds. And we've got to be very careful lest we are not compromised by that. Do we still speak about the truth to people that we meet with the same degree of ardent confidence and faith that we did in earlier days? We've got to be very careful lest the drift of political thought begins to wash upon ourselves as well. Well, coming back then to Isaiah 8, we've got to get through these next few verses very quickly. There was a remnant, you see, whilst many, verse 15, would stumble and fall and be broken and snared and taken, there was a remnant that would hearken to the study class, as it were, of Isaiah. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, as says the prophet. Or is it God speaking on behalf of his disciples? Certainly Isaiah had a following, but it would have been a limited following. The many were gone with the way of this people. But there was a smaller group who put their trust in Yahweh in very difficult times. I will wait, it says in verse 17, I will wait upon Yahweh that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Beautiful expression, so kindred to that in chapter 30 and verse 18. And therefore will Yahweh wait that he may be gracious unto you, and therefore will he be exalted that he may have mercy upon you. For Yahweh is a God of judgment. Blessed are all they that wait for him. He'll wait for you, you wait for him. So the idea of wait, which is the disposition of faith, is highlighted in this verse in Isaiah. I will wait upon Yahweh, who hides his face from the house of Jacob, and as he's hiding his face from the house of Jacob, I will look for him. Isn't that beautiful? So here is a remnant. The story of Shear Jashub, the remnant that would hearken to the prophet's words. And see, in verse 18, you can feel the loneliness that he is feeling, the pressure that is upon him as he's walking contrary to the way of the people of Israel, the people of Judah. Behold, he says, in the strait of his circumstances, behold, I and the children whom Yahweh hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from Yahweh of hosts who dwelleth in Mount Zion. There was his very family, assiduously walking in the right way. The children, Shear Jashub and Mahushalal Hashbaz, speaking about a remnant shall return and hastening the spoil as the invader would come down in that land upon the mercy of God and the judgment of God. A message, a gospel message, was being proclaimed by that family every time they went up the street. And Isaiah, standing in the middle of them, was saying that he was offering them the salvation of Yahweh, if they would. And did you notice the end of verse 18, the pertinence of those words? We are for signs and for wonders in Israel from Yahweh of hosts, who dwelleth in Mount Zion. And Ahaz can't send him out either. He might change the altar, he might change the offerings, but he can never rid Jerusalem of Yahweh. If the people put their faith in him and look unto him, he will be upon that city indeed, as he promised, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Yahweh our God, verse 10, is with us indeed. And so the little remnant must have been bolstered by that wonderful thought, that though the drift of the nation was to apostasy and ungodliness, yet they stayed firm unto the end. Tremendous exhortation, isn't it, for ourselves, living in the world in which we do, and sometimes even ecclesially, we have to stick to those things that we know are right. Stick and cling hold of those things, lest we gradually take into our homes the things that the Gentiles have and find that our way of life becomes the same as what the Gentile world has. We've got to preserve that separation, preserve that sense of the disciples of the prophets and apostles, and wait upon him. Well, verse 19 indicates that it wasn't just false gods, it was the spirit world also to which they were being sent. When they shall say unto you, seek unto them that have familiar spirits, and unto wizards that peep and that mutter. Should not a people seek unto their God? Should they, the living, seek to the dead? That's the sense of it. In other words, obviously not. Do living people go and speak to the dead to find out what they should do? What nonsense. You can see written right through the record here the name of King Saul, isn't it? That's exactly what he did. Time of national crisis with the Philistines up through the land. What did he do in that great distress? He forsook Yahweh and went to find the witch of Endor, that people that in earlier time he had eradicated from the land. But verse 20, to the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. The law and the testimony is that of verse 16, isn't it? The testimony and the law that was being bound up among the disciples of the prophet. And there was no other way. There was no other source of counsel and guidance. To the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, then there is no hope, no mourning, as the word light means. Did you notice the contrast with that speak the word, if they speak not according to this word, with the earlier expression in verse 10? take counsel together and it shall come to naught. Speak the word and it shall not stand. See the difference? Speak the word. Here we have the true word that comes from the law and the testimony. And if it doesn't come from that, then there is no light in them. You've got to remember that when we're choosing our books, don't we? A lot of us like to read, but what sort of things do we read? There's interesting books of all types, aren't there? But a lot of them not very helpful. Not a lot of them are very much profit at all. Especially those ones with paperbacks. You know, they're made with paperbacks very often because there's not much in them. And you wouldn't want to put too much money out to get them. Not all paperbacks are like that. But that's what they're generally like. We want to be very careful about the type of stuff we bring into our homes. In that and in other more deadly ways. To the law and to the testimony is the advice of the scripture. If they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no mourning in them. And there was no mourning, was there, for King Saul. When he came out of that witch's house by night, he had to face the Philistines the next day. The battle was all over before he started. It was finished. Well, here's another time. They shall pass through it, hardly be stead. Very be grieved and distressed, the word means, and hungry. And it shall come to pass that when they shall be hungry, they shall fret themselves and curse their king, that foolish king Ahaz, whose counsel about confederacy they had accepted for themselves to their own folly. They shall curse their king like those that followed King Saul, and their God, because their God was not Yahweh. They had forsaken him, hadn't he? To them his message, through Isaiah, was a stone of stumbling and a rock of offence. They stumbled at the word and they took hold of another god, the God of Damascus. They'll curse their king that led them in that way, and they'll curse their gods that they learnt from his adultery with the king of Assyria. And in their place they will look upward and go back to the little altar that was in the corner of the courtyard, despised and neglected, and look upward where they should find counsel and find their God again. They shall look unto the earth, but no hope. Trouble and darkness, dimness of anguish, and they shall be driven to darkness. And then the Revised Standard Version indicates that the next phrase of chapter 9 should really be linked with chapter 8, because it then says, but there will be no gloom for her that was in anguish. And that takes up the words which are in the previous phrase, the darkness and the dimness. So clearly the first little phrase of chapter 9 should be in chapter 8. In other words, despite all the terror and the gloom of verse 22, it will not be the end of the story. There will be no gloom for her that was in anguish. In the midst of their calamity, with the waters at the neck, with Jerusalem sitting there as a little cottage in a field, the only thing left, there would be no gloom. God was with them. God was their living God and their sanctuary, and because of that, he would provide for them succour in the time of calamity. Well, Isaiah is a most interesting book. It certainly has got some very wonderful matters for us, and I hope that as we go on to chapter 9, we will continue to enjoy the prophecy of Isaiah. Thank you.